If I were to ask you to name a group of people who built the fur trade with nothing but muscle, sinew, and sheer stubborn determination, you might name people like John Jacob Astor of the American Fur Company or William Henry Ashley of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. While these giants certainly helped mold it into something great, they didn't actually build it. For that, we have to credit a group of largely nameless Canadians who had become the lifeblood of the fur trade, the Voyageurs. These small-statured men were physically tough as an old boot, as pious as the Pope, and some say just as superstitious as they come. Today we're going to take a deep dive into the waterways of Canadian frontiers and meet these amazing men who very literally made the fur trade happen. If you recall your grade school history lessons, you'll recall that a guy named Samuel de Champlain came to the present-day Canada in 1608, and he set up a trading post in the St. Lawrence Valley. From that one little building, a trade network with the indigenous tribes began to blossom out across the untamed North American lands. And over the next 80-some years, tens of thousands of French settlers had come to this new world, which they called New France, and they established homesteads and built lives. The Seven-Year War happens between the British and the French, and the French essentially lose, and they are forced to cede all of their Canadian territories to the British, and its Louisiana territories to Spain. So Britain comes into power in Canada with the signing of the Treaty of Paris in 1763. For anyone who might be curious, the Acadian expulsions of the French by the British government had been going on since 1755. That's 8 years before now. This Treaty of Paris essentially helped usher in the end of that horrific nonsense. We'll cover Acadia in a dedicated episode, but know that we are at the tail end of that event. Now, most of the trading posts were established on the shores of Hudson's Bay, making it easier to get supplies offloaded and then reload the ships with these vast bundles of fur. But the industrious French and Russian trading companies were working inland, redirecting the furs away from the Bay Area, so the British had to start moving inland to capture that market. That meant hiring more bodies to transport supplies inland and the furs back to the Bay Area. So since the 1690s, the fur trade had been booming, and the now British traders needed the manpower to move that freight from one place to another. Since the inhabitants were all French, and the trading company bosses were primarily British, and their two countries had spent the last 7 years trying to kill each other, there was a good deal of mistrust between these two groups. So the British created contracts called engagements for all of their French new hires to sign. It essentially made the French man agree not to be a jerk to his boss, and the boss agreed to pay him for his service. It was written in legalese, of course, but that's the gist of it. And the contracts varied in length of service from just a summer job to up to 5 years of continuous service. And the people who signed up were called engages. Once the engage was firmly on the payroll, he became an indentured servant of sorts. He was paid, albeit poorly, and he received equipment, food, and shelter as part of his wages. You might think this sounds like a fair deal until you look deeper into what the boss qualifies as equipment, food, and shelter. For equipment, they were given one blanket, one shirt, one pair of trousers, and one pair of shoes. They might be given two of each if they signed up for longer contracts. Food rations usually consisted of 1 pound of corn, 1 quart of grease, and up to 8 pounds of meat of some kind, depending on how well the hunters made out that day. And that was only if those supplies were available. Oftentimes they weren't. Shelter was an overturned canoe. That's it. They might throw a piece of canvas over the side like a tent if it was bad weather. And this is Canada in the winter. I guarantee there was bad weather. So if you've got 8 to 14 guys all in the same canoe, you're really good friends underneath that canoe when it's time to sleep. Any land that was deemed to be Indian land was said to be pays d'en haut. It's spelled P-A-Y-S-D-apostrophe-E-N-H-A-U-T, and it's pronounced pays d'en haut. This is the wilderness through which these guys are earning their pay. Now, the promised pay depended on your job description as well as your position within the canoe itself. At the top of the chain was the master, which the low-ranking voyagers mockingly called him bourgeois. And it's from this term that the American rendezvous system gets the term bourgeois. In French, the word bourgeois meant middle class, and it's a kind of snide reference to this master's love of material things. In American slang today, we call it bougie, and it's all sharing the same root word. So the bourgeois, or master, was the guy in charge. He assigned the men of his brigade to various positions. The best paid were the men who had a few years of experience under their belts. They were called the Northmen. They would be expected to sign a 3 to 5 year contract and live full-time in the wilderness, just like the men of the American fur trade era that we're already familiar with. The next best position to be assigned to was either the devant, at the front of the canoe, or the gouvernail, which was the guy at the back doing the steering or ruddering. Collectively, these two positions, the devant and the gouvernail, are called bouts. If you're one of those unfortunate souls assigned to the middle, whose only hope at beautiful scenery is looking out the side window, so to speak, you are known as a milieu, meaning middle. For anyone who signed on as a summer job, no matter where in the canoe you sat, your fellow voyagers had a derogatory nickname for you. These men were called pork eaters. So the workday begins between 2 a.m. and 4:30 a.m., and it would often end about 18 hours later. 7 days a week, no Sundays off, no holidays. During that 18-hour workday, a voyager can expect to paddle like a madman, interspersed with carrying an entire canoe load of stuff, sometimes hundreds of miles across land to the next waterway. This carrying of the stuff over land is called portaging. Americans say portaging. And I want to take a minute here and paint that picture in modern times for you. You are happily paddling your canoe downriver, and you come to a pretty little lake with no outlet. The next river is 2 miles east. So you beach your canoe on the east side of the lake, and now you have to get everything over to that next river. So you unload the goods on the beach, and you begin hauling all of your stuff out of it. Your backpack, your bedroll, your food stuff, your first aid kit, your cooking gear, all of this has to be carried 2 miles to the next beach. But wait, so does the canoe. So now you have to make 2 trips, 2 miles there and 2 miles back each time to get the canoe and your personal effects over there. If you happen to be hauling 100-pound bales of fur, you're going to have to carry each one of those as well. And you better have your machete in hand because the woods you're tromping through are thick with undergrowth. Best carry a weapon on account of wild animals and hostile natives. To say that these guys were human pack mules is an understatement. So let's look at that work schedule again. Up to 18 hours a day, no paid holidays, though you might get lucky and get a day off once in a while for really horrible weather. But that was a double-edged sword. You might get the day off to catch up on sleep, but please remember you're sleeping under the flipped-over canoe in that horrible weather with everybody else who's in your canoe. Now, if you've ever seen that reality TV show where brave truckers are pushing themselves in their vehicles like crazed madmen trying to beat the spring thaw, just imagine it in reverse. These men are trying to beat the winter ice. So they push themselves to the point of exhaustion to get the furs to the final staging point before the waterways froze over. The farther away they're working from the administration center, the harder and faster they have to paddle to get done in time. So let's review. Lousy pay, grueling hours, dangerous work conditions, meager equipment, sparse time off, and almost zero benefits. Would you sign up for this? I wouldn't. So why did they? To understand this, we're going to have to look to see what their alternatives are. Life in New France at this time was a type of feudal system. The people farmed, and most of the farms were self-sustaining homesteads. Taxes were paid either in cash or in crops to the landlord. This system works all well and good until a few crop failures hit, or a few more mouths are added to the family food budget. After a few years of crop failure, some of the men had no choice but to sign on with the fur companies to collect that extra income. But for some, it was a sense of duty and family tradition. Their fathers and their grandfathers before them navigated these waterways, and they were taking up the torch to honor that familial duty. And for some, it was that age-old desire for freedom from the mundane life of the farm. They had that insatiable yearning to see the untamed wilderness, to see the unspoiled beauty of the world, or to face the challenges that Mother Nature would throw at them and see how they would measure up. It's not like this is a small workforce. In a letter from the fur trader Joe Frobisher, he said Northwest Company employed 500 voyagers that year in 1784. By 1816, only 32 years later, it's estimated some 2,000 men were in the trade. So let's take a closer look at these men. They were primarily non-literate people. In their minds, they really didn't need to be literate. They only needed to be hardworking and God-fearing. And in this, they were most definitely dedicated. The French were wholeheartedly Catholic. In fact, it's partially because of these religious differences between the Catholic French voyagers and their Protestant British bosses that the British clerks, who were the ones writing things down since the French couldn't write, painted a picture of overly superstitious and sometimes paranoid French idiots. But what one man calls superstition, another man calls a ritual. For example, my Protestant grandmother threw salt over her shoulder if the shaker was spilled. She believed it kept her family safe from bad things. On the other side of my family, my Catholic relatives observe rituals like baptism to protect their families. All of these actions can be seen as performing a ritual based on the belief that what you can't see can hurt you. The only difference is how that action connects to a supreme being. But these French voyagers are Catholic, so nearly everything they did is connected to the supreme being. We have to remember, too, that these men were far away from any priest or church, and they had to pull from their collective memories to practice their faith and keep it alive. In the absence of a weekly mass, the voyagers showed their dedication to God in the best way they knew how. An example of this is the Catholic ritual of baptism. For non-religious folks, here's a quick overview. Long before the Christians started doing it, the Jewish culture used something like baptism to symbolize repentance and purification. The Christians adapted it to be symbolic of being washed free of sin and committed to Christ. These voyagers used it many times throughout their lives on the frontiers. New recruits would have a small baptism-style ceremony just before their first departure, and another each time they reached a certain landmark within their journey. And these baptisms accomplished a few things. First, it gave the new guy a sense of inclusion. He was now part of the brotherhood of voyagers. And that'll go a very long way for a homesick, anxious new recruit. It also gave the new guy a sense of progression for his first journey. Each new baptism spot was achieving the next milestone of an otherwise brutally difficult and physically demanding trip. But it also served a purpose for the guys who weren't new. It allowed the veterans to humble themselves before God on a regular basis. And this is really helpful to keep one's faith strong in the absence of a priest or a weekly mass. And finally, it helped break up the monotony of a very, very long trip. Many of these mock baptisms were held in locations of exceptional grandeur and natural wonder. The voyagers saw these places as proof of God's greatness and approached them with extreme reverence. So we know our voyagers were pious people. Let's see why the Brits think they're superstitious fools. Besides the Catholic influence, they were also heavily influenced by their native friends and family members. Many had married into local indigenous populations and adopted those beliefs and rituals. They basically took the symbolism of both beliefs and merged them together to create something unique. So, for example, one of these baptisms in the shadow of a grand mountain range full of natural beauty and peace might include the Catholic sprinkling of water on the forehead to be followed with a native offering of tobacco to the four directions. Even today, tobacco offerings are an integral part of native ceremony. So it makes sense that the voyagers would have incorporated all of these influences in their rite of passage ceremonies. Sometimes they would give up an offering to ensure fair weather or a safe journey. A quick prayer to Saint Anne, mother of the Virgin Mary and patron saint of sailors and travelers, would be followed by an offering of flint, cornmeal, or tobacco into the water. So hopefully you can see how these two cultures meld into something uniquely Voyager. In fact, there's one ritual I found that made me smile. To help you understand my meaning, I want to share a story with you that a native elder once told me at a powwow way back in the 90s. He told me of an Indian man who wanted to have a family meeting with his wife and kids. So he called them all together, but they had a new kitten in the house, and the kids were playing around, distracted by the antics of this really cute kitten. So the old man takes the kitten and he sticks it under an overturned basket in front of him. When the rambunctious kitten starts bouncing the basket around, the kids all laugh and carry on. So the old man put his feet on the basket to hold it down, and he continues on with his family meeting undisturbed. The next time he's going to hold the meeting, the kitten again distracts the family with its overwhelming cuteness. So he again places it under the basket in front of him, puts his feet on the basket, and continues on with the meeting. See, he's getting smart now. When it's time for the next meeting, he grabs up the kitten ahead of time, sticks it under the basket, puts his feet on it, and then calls the family together. And the meeting goes off without a hitch. Over the years, he prepares for his family meeting in the same way, grabbing the now-grown cat, sticking it under the basket, and propping his feet on the basket. And this goes on for 9 or 10 years this way. One day, the cat dies of old age, and the family is completely distraught. Not only have they lost their beloved pet, but they can't hold their family meeting anymore because they have nothing to put under the basket. I hope this helps you understand how a series of repetitive actions can become ritual. And these men developed rituals out of habitual action. For example, when leaving one stream and turning into another, at least one of the men, if not all of them, in the boat, would remove their hats, make the sign of the cross, and repeat a short prayer. And as each of them were adapting their beliefs based on outside influences, another might follow that prayer with an offering of tobacco, and another might follow that with an offering of flint or corn, and yet another might follow that with a kiss to the small silver crucifix that hung from his neck, and so on. When you do this often enough, it becomes a ritual with well-established steps to take. And upcoming generations pick up these rituals and they add their own little tidbits to it, and the ritual evolves. What I find amazing is that out of the 5 to 15 guys in the same boat, they each had melded these cultures to have an individual flair on what was serving a universal purpose. And those posh Brits who were the ones documenting all of this, they see this series of steps, dropping the tobacco, offering the corn, kissing the crucifix, and they equate that to being superstitious. So let's look at the equipment they would be wearing. Shirts and pants for the American mountain man were usually constructed of buckskin or buffalo hide, but these voyagers were constantly in the water. Anyone who's ever been caught in a downpour in buckskins will tell you they get really heavy when they get wet, and they're cold, and they take a very long time to dry. So voyagers wore clothes made of quick-drying materials, like linen or cotton. They would often cover their lower legs with mitas, or leggings made of two pieces of animal hide sewn together. Think of it like a pair of what we today would call gaiters or leggings. They're usually buckskin from the top of the shoe to the knee, and they're tied on tight around the calf with a short piece of sash. We know from their contracts they were issued one shirt, one pair of pants, a blanket, and shoes. From there, they developed individual styles by implementing some of the things they saw their native friends wearing, or maybe decorating their jacket with something they had traded for. Now, the coats were made from leather, heavy wool, or layers of linen. And this is where the capote, as we know it, is born. For those new to the lingo, a capote is a heavy wool coat sewn out of a wool blanket. We'll cover this much, much more in the Hudson's Bay Company episode, which is coming soon. And these coats were held closed with a wide sash with arrowhead or lightning patterns. We need to stop here a second and look at this sash. This sash was the multi-tool of its day. It was used for obvious purposes, like holding one's pants up, but it was also a firewood carrier. and it was placed around the forehead to carry heavy bundles when they were portaging. It's also believed that these 6-inch-wide sashes could have been giving them lower back support, like a lumbar belt would do today. I heard one story about how one of the voyagers had broken his arm, and he used his sash as a sling until he could get out of the wilderness to receive treatment. And while these sashes were originally worn for practical purposes, they soon became a symbol of identity. Different colors and patterns identified which family you belonged to. Now, the indigenous people who created these sashes for the voyagers were known as the Métis. These people are the offspring of indigenous mothers and European fathers, and they still wear these sashes today as a means of identifying their heritage. They can tell what family each other came from by the colors and patterns on their sashes. Now, for you fellow weavers, the method of weaving they use to make these sashes is a form of finger weaving. And there is a plethora of videos on how to make these and what their symbols and colors mean. I highly recommend you watch at least one of the videos because it shows you what went into making these sashes. Some of them took upwards of 200 hours to weave. The unique red caps they wore would also become a symbol of their identity. These are the triangle-shaped knit caps that have the point at the top draped over one side of the head and a tassel hanging from the point. These today are known as Voyager caps, named after these industrious canoe paddlers. For their company-issued shoes, finding a size to fit one's individual feet could be a challenge. Just ask anyone today who wears a half-size shoe or has an extra-wide foot. Even in modern times, finding the exact size can be a challenge for some people. So in the days before modern half-size charts and mass production, it must have been even harder. And if your job requires you to be constantly jumping in and out of a canoe into water, having an ill-fitting shoe is going to be sheer torture. So many of these guys gave up their employer-issued shoes for native moccasins. In fact, moccasins were the number one item they sent back home to their loved ones, followed by unique feathers. Okay, so we know their kit was part of their wage. Let's see what they actually earned in cold hard cash. Well, British pound sterling. The Devant and the Gouvernail, those men at the front and back of the canoe, generally got paid slightly higher than the poor schlep in the middle. In 1790, the Milou, those middle guys, earned about 15 British pounds a year, whereas the Devant and the Gouvernail, those guys on the ends, earned about 25. By 1800, they had all got substantial raises, with the Milou now earning about 25 and the Buits earning around 42 British pounds sterling. And we also know that anyone who acted as an interpreter earned between 42 and 125 a year, which was good wage. In 1802, the Milou's wages jumped dramatically to be between 80 and 125 British pounds sterling, whereas the Buits earned upwards of 125. But then in 1824, they all dropped down again, where the Milou are back to about 20 pounds British sterling, and the helmsmen and the sternsmen are still at 125. Now, the end goal for these long, arduous trips was to reach the administration centers placed strategically throughout the wilderness. The farther away from the administration center you were working, the more money you made. So the guy working within, say, 25 miles of Fort William, Ontario, made a set amount of money. But the guy working in the wild lands of Alberta, 1,000 miles away, could make up to 150% more. Wages were usually paid annually in a lump sum, and new recruits were often given an advance on that wage so they could stock up on supplies, which was generally up to a third of his total salary. They could also earn extra money by doing odd jobs for the bourgeois and the bosses, like hunting, hauling water and wood, or acting as a guide. There's even one account of one voyager making some extra cash by landscaping one of the administration centers. But they also did odd jobs for competing fur companies, and would even hire themselves out to each other. So if Joe Voyager didn't feel like doing his chores one day, he could pay Fred Voyager to do it for him. The Voyagers could use their earnings then to buy things like rum or tobacco from the company coffers. However, since they didn't actually get cash in hand on a regular basis, the company took it off their wages at the end of the year when paychecks came out. If they were already in the hole, they were essentially cut off from buying new supplies. And sometimes, particularly when they were way out in the wilderness, away from these administrative centers, they got paid in goods rather than money. This meant there was no cash to send home to their families. And generally, they did send their money home. Now, there were more than a few that simply stopped sending money home. They instead saved up to buy their freedom from the contracts, or to live with new Aboriginal wives and kids. So some families back east didn't see their voyagers for 5 or so years, depending on the length of their contract, and some never saw them again. Their men just dropped off the map. And we know this to be a fact because of one of the craziest accidents in history. Most of these guys worked for Hudson's Bay Company, and Hudson's Bay Company was notoriously neurotic when it came to keeping records. They even had a mail room of sorts that families of the voyagers could send mail to, and they would then forward the mail out into the wilderness to the companies. Well, by some stroke of luck, 16 letters from family members to the voyagers got lost. They were shuffled under something and forgotten, and they ended up never being delivered. In fact, those 16 letters are still in the archives of the company today. And those letters tell us a lot about how the family struggled without the support of their voyager. One woman begs the company commander to send her man home. Another says she hasn't seen her son in a decade and asks the company commander to make him write home to her. It's a wonderful insight into what life was like back then while your voyager was out earning his pay. Now, these voyagers were employees of the fur company. And like any company, there were often restructurings of the workforce. One master might shuffle a man out due to illness or injury, or trade with another master if that guy had one he took an interest in. They often swap men for certain qualities, like a sense of humor or a quick wit. This meant a man might start in one area of Canada, only to be sent to a completely different area. Many of the loved ones sending letters had a hard time keeping track of where exactly their loved ones were. And most times, the letters weren't addressed. They only had the name of their loved one on the front. If it was a common name, it might mean the letter went to the wrong guy and had to be sent back to the mailroom for redelivery. And the voyagers themselves acted as the mail carriers between places like Montreal and these groups of men that were stationed out in the administrative centers. They were ferrying letters and documents back and forth. Starting around 1799, something new began happening with their wages. 1 to 2% was being whacked off the top for something called a pension. This pension is just what we think of today when we say the word pension. Each voyager contributed part of his wages to a giant savings account, and that went towards taking care of the old and the infirmed voyagers. Granted, the pension they received was only 10 British pounds sterling, and I'm not sure just how far that would go today, since that's only equivalent to about 240 American dollars. But still, this was fairly advanced thinking to be planning on taking care of your retirees and your injured. So besides their clothing and promised wages, they were also promised other equipment. This would be their shelter slash mode of transportation, the canoe. Typically, these were birch bark canoes with a frame of cedar wood and layers of bark from the paper birch stretched over that frame. And they have a number of different sizes and styles of canoes in their arsenal. So let's see if we can equate these incredible canoes to something a little more relatable today. The first, the Canot de Matre, or the Montreal canoe, sometimes called the master's canoe, was used on big waterways like the Great Lakes or the massive Ottawa River. It was 35 to 36 feet long and about 6 foot wide. Think of a mid-sized school bus today, which is the same length but about a foot wider than the canoe would be. Now, in that mini bus-sized canoe, place one guy in the front, the devant, and one guy in the back, the gouvernant, and place 8 guys in the middle seats to paddle. The canoe itself weighs nearly 600 pounds. In it, around these 8 paddlers, we're going to place 3 tons of cargo. That's about how much a Chevy Suburban or a Ford F-350 Super Duty weighs. So 10 guys, a canoe the size of a bus, cargo that weighs as much as a full-size truck, oh, and their food, gear, and supplies, and they have to portage this 200 feet over scrub bushes and rocky ground. You can see why they were physically fit. In fact, to portage, they usually just flip the canoe upside down and place it on the shoulders of 4 to 6 guys, 2 in the front, 2 in the back, and sometimes 2 on the side. They even had special shoulder pads they wore to protect their necks and their shoulders. And they'd walk it overland to the next waterway and then go back for their gear. But not all the canoes were this big. The northern canoe was about 25 feet long and 4 feet wide. Not much larger than many that we use today in the U.S. It was usually manned by 5 to 6 men, but it could hold up to 8. And it weighed about half of the master's canoe size, so it rang in at about 300 pounds. But it also held half the load, around 1,500 pounds. And 2 men could comfortably portage this, usually in the upright position. They just put it up on their heads and carried it across the land. Now, the bastard canoe was a hybrid between these 2 big canoes. It was between 25 and 30 feet long, and it could be manned by between 6 and 8 men. There was even a smaller version that was roughly 15 feet long and can be maneuvered by 2 to 4 men. And then you had the super light, super fast express version. This held almost no cargo, but more men, and it could be paddled at lightning fast speeds, making some distances of up to 65 miles a day. So besides the smaller canoes of their native friends and the giant wooden York boats that were these massive flat-bottom, half-sailed, half-oared boats that used on the big lakes, these are the methods by which our voyagers transported thousands of pounds of fur from one place to the next. Now, on these journeys, these men would have a master, or the boss. He's stationed in one of the big canoes, and he's barking out orders, telling them what to do. But that would only happen if there was something to watch for. Generally, they were sitting there with the same 8 or 9 guys they've been stuck with for 100 miles now. One could see how that would get old real quick. To fight the boredom, they would tell each other stories, talk about their loved ones back home, and exchange jokes and jibes. And then one starts to sing. It's a tune familiar to them all, since they were toddlers. It's about a little game bird, and the singer is warning this game bird that he's going to pluck its head off, pluck its beak off, put out its eyes, take off its wings and tail. And while this may sound horrible to our modern sensitivities, the singer's talking about preparing a bird to be cooked. And unless you've been living under a rock your whole life, I guarantee you've heard the song. It goes, Alouette, gentle alouette, alouette, jette de plumore. Okay, so my horrible singing aside, songs like these served a few purposes. Think back to the last time you heard your favorite song from the 80s playing on the radio. Were you not instantly reminded of how big and awesome your hair looked back then? Or a particularly cool car that you owned? By singing these songs they were also familiar with, it gave the men a sense of nostalgic happiness. It also helped them stay awake during these long, tedious journeys, much like we would blare the radio or kick on the air conditioning in the car when we're getting road weary. Now, there were different kinds of songs. The beautiful, romantic French love ballad, the sad lamentations to fellow voyagers who went before their time, and then there was the work songs that would be ad-libbed and often changed with each rendition of it. And these songs did something better. It gave them a rhythm to paddle to. Much like you see sailors singing shanties and everyone pulls on the ropes at the same time at a particular part of the song, or Scottish women walking wool while they sing a Gaelic tune, these voyagers use these songs to keep in time with each other. And amazingly, a fur trader and a clerk for Hudson's Bay Company, a man by the name of Edward Ermatinger, collected some of these songs and he put them down in writing between the years of 1818 and 1828. He even wrote out the notes to some of them. It's the first time, as far as we know, that music was ever recorded for posterity from this era. Now, we know that they did occasionally break up these trials and tribulations with a little rest and relaxation at something called a rendezvous. See, we stole that term from them as well. And this was similar to the trading events that William Henry Ashley and Andrew Henry later held in the Rocky Mountains, the ones that myself and so many others still portray. These events were a chance to catch up with old friends, drink and play cards, and relax before getting back to the hard labor of paddling. Besides using these occasional events and using songs to make their trip a little more palatable, they also gave names to various places they paddled through. They might be funny names, which would cause all of the men in the canoe to laugh. Or it might be a harbinger of danger. For example, if a particular rock formation resembled a gateway, and the next water feature was a dangerous rapids, they'd nickname it the Gates of Hell. These place names help them prepare for rough waters ahead and particularly dangerous area. When they would spy these harbingers of danger on their next trip, they'd briefly kneel, pull out the rosary from around their necks, and pray for deliverance. Now, speaking of rapids, if there were dangerous waterfalls involved, the men would often portage around it and safely relaunch their canoes farther downstream where the water is calmer. But this took a very long time to accomplish. So more often than not, they would just shoot through the rapids and the small waterfalls. This was dangerous and could sometimes end in disaster with all hands lost, particularly if they didn't know how to swim. And most voyagers did not. Some of the stories of the things that they saw in these journeys, too, are just unbelievable. In one story, a canoe was trying to escape hostile Iroquois natives when the Virgin Mary appeared to stand on the bow of the boat. The natives fell back in fear, and the men escaped unscathed. One story tells of three strange lights appearing ahead of the canoe to show them the way through particularly treacherous narrows. And strangely enough, different men seeing this all interpreted it to mean something different. One said Peter and Paul were guiding the Virgin Mary to deliver them. And one said that the three lights meant that three men would soon drown. And yet another said that only three men would survive an impending disaster. It's interesting how eight guys stuck in the same boat for endless hours can each see things from a different perspective. Now, some of them were superstitious. They believed in wendigos and skinwalkers, which probably came from the influence of native tribes who had these same monsters in their mythos. And while they would stop and pay reverence to any wooden cross erected along their trail, including those serving as headstones for the recently deceased, they also stopped and paid their respects to any of the Jesuit missionaries they came across. They gave equal respect to the native holy sites. When one of their own was lost, a Catholic burial was held to their best that their memory served, and burial rites were also altered slightly by the absence of an actual priest, and they would incorporate native actions into this ritual. If one of their native wives died, they were baptized by the voyagers before being laid out in a Catholic-style burial. Although the pension program was successful, there wasn't really such a thing as retirement. Some of them did spend their twilight years with their native families, or returned home to loved ones waiting back east. Most of them didn't live terribly long past the age of the 50s. They fell victim to illness and injury caused by carrying excessive amounts of weight for long periods of time. The extreme physical demands took a great toll on their bodies, leaving them with hernias and internal ruptures, hip, back, and knee problems, and severe arthritis. And yet even more of them succumbed to the environment, dying on the job when a canoe capsized or hostile natives rained arrows down upon them. And their constant battle with the elements wasn't always successful. Now, we have talked a lot about the French voyagers, so let's talk about all the other ones. Because there were Russians, British, Spanish, Scottish, Irish, colonial Americans, and amazingly, those from the Sandwich Islands, which we today call Hawaii. In 1811, the Pacific Fur Company took a trip to the Hawaiian Islands and recruited 24 indigenous islanders to work for them, 12 as ship hands and 12 as voyagers. These people were big and strong and already masters at handling canoes, but they also could do something that most other voyagers could not. They could swim. Which, if you think about it, makes complete sense that a Polynesian canoe culture member would feel at home in a world where paddling was the goal. But my point is, this wasn't strictly a French endeavor. And companies like Hudson's Bay Company, they didn't care where you came from as long as you were willing to work hard for the benefits they offered. In fact, they were really only interested in how tall you were. It sounds silly, doesn't it? This is one of those times in life when it pays to be short. And it actually makes a whole lot of sense when you think about it. A canoe can only hold so much weight before the water comes up past the point of buoyancy and sinks the canoe. If you have a guy that weighs 100 pounds and a guy that weighs 200 pounds, but they can paddle both at the same rate, putting the guy who weighs less in the boat is the smarter move. It leaves more room for bales of fur. So besides the influences of the French culture, the native culture, the Catholic culture, now you're bringing in all these other cultures from as far away as Hawaii. And this creates something amazing and unique and puts the voyagers in a class all their own. And it's to these men that the people of Canada owe their thanks. They are the ones who built Canada. They are the ones who served as the lifeblood in the veins of waterways that fed the heart of the fur trade. That same fur trade that eventually networked south to become the era that we ourselves love to portray. In fact, Canadian author Peter C. Newman describes the voyagers as a, and I quote, "remarkable ragbag of magnificent river rats." Another wonderful quote I found is from Harold Adams Innes's book, his 1930s book called The Fur Trade in Canada. And he writes, "Like comic book heroes, voyagers have a highly visible reputation, building the Canadian nation with their Herculean strength, while singing, laughing, leaping over waterfalls, and paddling faster than speeding arrows." But probably my all-time favorite saying comes from Grace Lee Knute's 1931 book, The Voyager. She writes, "His canoe has long since vanished from the northern waters. His red cap is seen no more, a bright spot against the blue of Lake Superior. His sprightly French conversation, punctuated with inimitable gesture, his exaggerated courtesy, his incurable romanticism, his songs and his superstitions are gone." That's it for this week's episode. I thank you all for paddling along with me on this journey, and I hope you have a better sense of how much we owe it to the voyagers for creating the world we love so much. Join me in a few weeks for another episode, and please check out the website for great links to resources pertaining to our era, fursandfrontiers.com. Have a great weekend, everybody. Keep your powder dry.